Good morning. I'm Art Bell for George Norrie. Let me quote Dr. Hansen briefly. These models reveal a miserable situation at present, referring to the climate, but a dire one in the years ahead. In his December speech to the Geophysical Union, he noted that carbon dioxide emissions are now, quote, surging well above, end quote, the point where damage to the planet might be limited. Speaking to a reporter from the Washington Post, he put it bluntly, having raised the Earth's temperature 1 degree Fahrenheit in the past three decades, we're facing another increase of 4 degrees over the next century. That would imply changes, listen carefully, that constitute practically a different planet. The technical terms for those changes include drought, famine, pestilence, and flood. It's not something we can adapt to, he continued. We can't let it go another 10 years like this. Does that sound like Dr. Hansen?
Well, it doesn't sound like what he used to sound like. It sounds like the way he sounds these days, yes.
Yes.
Yeah, he's on a mission.
What is it, Dr. Spencer, do you think that convinced Dr. Hansen that it was this dire?
I think when he finally put together a model explanation that basically highlights carbon dioxide as the prime, if not the only reason we've warmed in the last 50 to 100 years. So, as I mentioned before, he's come up with a theoretical explanation, which I think is one possible explanation for the current warmth, and then also based on these feedbacks. Remember, we discussed feedbacks.
Of course.
He assumes there are certain positive feedbacks going on in the climate system, and then, you know, you run these models out into the future to see how much it's going to warm. Well, you know, depending on what you put in for the feedbacks, you can get warming from anywhere from 2 degrees Fahrenheit to, you know, 12 degrees Fahrenheit by the end of this century. It's a huge range.
Well, let's talk about feedbacks a little bit.
Yeah.
I mentioned the one with the water melting at the North Pole. What other possible feedbacks would be considered in that kind of modeling, Doctor?
Okay, the most important feedback in the climate system is the positive water vapor feedback, which we're all, in a sense, familiar with, that the warmer it gets, the more water is evaporated from the surface.
Sure.
And water vapor is the main greenhouse gas in the atmosphere. It's about 90% of our greenhouse effect is due to water vapor, not carbon dioxide. It's self-regulating by precipitation. And that's the one thing that climate modelers don't tell you about. They say, well, we know that if it warms, there's got to be more water vapor evaporating into the atmosphere. Well, yeah, but that's only half the story. The amount of water vapor evaporating into the atmosphere isn't what determines how much water vapor is in the atmosphere. It's the balance between that and how much is constantly being taken out by precipitation. If we didn't have precipitation systems, in a matter of days, the atmosphere would be filled up with fog, you know, everywhere, globally.
Sure. Wow.
It would be a fog-enveloped planet, and that doesn't happen. And that's because precipitation systems are constantly removing water vapor through precipitation processes. Well, we really don't know hardly anything about how these precipitation systems behave as the atmosphere warms, except that we do know, at least qualitatively, that precipitation systems in the tropics are more efficient at removing water from the atmosphere than at high latitudes. So this is one of the feedbacks that I think is overstated in climate models, is this positive water vapor feedback effect.
Okay.
And it's, in a way, it's hard to separate any of these feedbacks from each other because they're all interrelated. It's like you can't talk about just one of them without getting into the other. So, you know, clouds, on the average, cool the climate. But we really don't have a good feeling for how they're going to change with warming. Are they going to change in such a way to screen out some sunlight and cancel out some of the warming, keeping the Earth more at a constant temperature? Or will they change in such a way with a positive feedback to amplify the warming? And for that, climate models are kind of all over the map of what they predict for clouds, because we really don't understand clouds at all.
So do you think that he objectively believes that this climate model that we're talking about, the one that has him speaking out like this, and obviously he must have quite a bit of faith in it for some reason?
Yes. Yeah, he does.
Why?
Well, I mean, this is common with all scientists, people that work in their own specific field with how they've approached the problem, with the models and tools that they have built. You know, we're all parochial. We all like to believe that we've got the best one.
Sure.
And he's worked in this a long time and put a lot of work into his model. So I can completely understand him believing it. And in fact, his may be the best model out of the 20 or so models that are run around the world, you know, to tackle this problem.
Well, is there any objective evidence that it is the best? I've seen it referred to as the best by some. Is that likely?
Well, I don't know how you would say best. Because, you know, if the trouble is that, you know, we've had some up and down temperature fluctuations in the last 100 years. Just a few. They can be explained in probably an infinite number of ways. But since we really don't know the natural variability, what we do is we use the tools that we have, which is basically increasing carbon dioxide, changes in aerosols, either man-made aerosols or volcanic aerosols, and a few other processes that we think we understand. And if you put them together in a certain way, you can pretty much explain what's happened in the last 100 years globally for the global average temperature fluctuations. Now, is that really what caused it? We don't know. You know, you come up with one possible explanation, but the climate system, I think, is so complex, I don't have a whole lot of faith that is the what's going on. Also, even if it is, it could be that in the future, once we warm up a certain amount more, that some unknown feedback kicks in and brings us back toward equilibrium. I think that there's just a lot of uncertainty.
But, well, I've heard it say Mother Nature doesn't get angry, she gets even. And you know,
that's a cute phrase, but I think for the most part, the climate system is pretty darn resilient.
Well, it kind of referred to what you said, though. It really means there's no actual intelligence saying, look, I've got to correct this. It's just a system, as you put it, of feedback that once something is out of balance in one way, I guess the climate finds a way to reverse that process.
Yes, right. That's my belief.
Getting even. That's what the getting even part is. And I guess we can all hope that's true, although I don't know what Mother Nature might do to restore that balance. From our perspective, I suppose that could be not a happy situation.
Yeah, who knows? But what we do know is that no matter where you live on this earth, you have to deal with certain weather hazards. Okay? You know, whether it's typhoons, hurricanes, winter storms, floods, droughts, they all happen. Now, maybe they will get somewhat worse with global warming, but the point is that we have to deal with them anyway. It's kind of like this whole thing about the hurricanes hitting the Gulf Coast last year.
Yes.
You know, so many people think, oh, well, they want to blame global warming for the whole thing. Well, I'm sorry. Category 4 and 5 hurricanes have always occurred. They always will occur. They're going to hit land occasionally. Maybe they'll get worse with global warming. Maybe they won't. But I could see that maybe they will. But you still have to be prepared for a Category 4 or 5 hurricane, because they're going to hit with or without the help of mankind.
I'm sure you're correct. But I recall watching who I thought was a very good meteorologist on CNN, though somewhat temperamental, but very good. And he was just astounded at the rapid pressure drop, in fact, down at one point to a pressure that had never been measured before, and how quickly it got there. He was just shaking his head going, oh my God, and it's aimed, you know, right at this warm water ahead of it and so forth and so on. And
that's happened. That typically happens more in the Pacific. There's been, you know, that's where the biggest hurricanes, and of course they're called typhoons there, have occurred, you know, with those rapid pressure drops and the lowest pressures ever recorded. But remember, It hasn't been that many years that they've been flying into these things and measuring these pressures. I think we really don't know how many tropical storms there were before, let's say, around 1970, when we were starting to get more routine satellite data.
That's very good.
Because it's a big ocean out there.
Sure is. I've been through many a typhoon on Okinawa, and yes, they get to be very large. Of course, they have a lot more ocean to cross before they strike. And so if the conditions are right, they can get absolutely ridiculously violent.
Yeah, well, that's also typically a warmer ocean. The Western Pacific is typically warmer than the Western Atlantic.
Mm-hmm. Is it fair to characterize hurricanes and typhoons as the Earth's air conditioner? In other words, they convert warm ocean water and toss it into the atmosphere, in essence, and it's a kind of a cooling process?
It's basically one of the modes by which the excess heat that builds up at the surface of the Earth is transported away from the surface and up into the atmosphere, where that excess energy can then be lost to outer space in the form of heat radiation. So, yeah, it's like part of the air conditioning process, like you said, if you want to put it in those terms. It's one of the modes by which the atmosphere moves heat away from the surface and keeps the surface of the Earth at a habitable temperature for us. If it weren't for weather, the effects of weather and water vapor, especially water vapor evaporating from the surface, the average surface temperature over the whole Earth, averaged over the whole Earth, poles and to the tropics, the average would be about 135 to 140 degrees Fahrenheit.
Wow.
But because of the effects of water and weather systems, we have what we currently have, which is like about 55 degrees Fahrenheit average.
So weather is very, very important to our survival.
Yeah, so you got to have hurricanes.
Yes,
they help.
I guess some
people, when they hit you.
Yeah, they're not. And some people, doctor, would say, well, that's why we're having these really horrible hurricanes, because it is warmer, and so the air conditioner is cranked up harder. But of course, you would say, nonsense.
Well, I would say, okay, so mankind has made it warmer in the Atlantic, but not in the Pacific, because, you know, they're below normal for typhoons. Again, we know that there's been these cycles, these natural cycles, in the general circulation of the atmosphere that changes not just the temperature, but the wind shear conditions. It takes more than warm sea surface temperatures to build a hurricane. Otherwise, they'd have hurricanes in the Arabian Sea, in the Mediterranean Sea, and in other areas where there aren't ever any hurricanes, because the wind shear conditions aren't right. So it just was, you know, this last year, everything came together perfect, if you want to put it that way, for a lot of hurricanes.
Yeah, this story from the Boston Globe ends this way. It says, you can argue with Hansen if you want, but you better bring along a pretty big data set with you. He's been right so far. Mm-hmm. Now, is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think he's been predicting increasing increasing temperatures for the last 10 years. That, you know, on average each year was probably going to be warmer than the previous one,
right?
Which is sort of borne out. But when even if there are just natural climate fluctuations going on, these things have a long time scale. In other words, once you get into a warm period, you're going to be warm for years on end. So it's a pretty easy bet to say we're going to stay above normal for a while. But yeah, it's risky business to predict climate, and he's so far probably done a better job than anybody.
All right. You have worked a little bit with passive microwave remote sensing techniques. There's somebody with an idea. You know, when you talk about energy, I mean, even our president came out recently and said we're addicted to oil. We certainly are. There are all kinds of ideas out there about how to collect and transport energy. And one of the wilder ones, but maybe not too wild, you might want to comment, is to put solar collection in space and then microwave what's collected back to Earth.
Yeah, and I know there's people working on that. There's two major problems. One is the extra expense of putting that solar collector into orbit.
Right.
To get an extra, you know, whatever, maybe an extra 50% amount of sunlight on average, falling on the solar collector. I mean, it takes a lot of money to put stuff into space.
You're here.
So there's that issue, is how much it costs to put a big solar collector up there to begin with. Now, to beam the energy down, you would have to have such a huge microwave antenna to make a very narrow beam.
Yes.
It would have to be very tightly controlled to come down in one spot. Otherwise, you're going to start frying your neighbors.
Well, I've brought this subject up to people who are advocates of this, and they say, don't worry. It's got an absolute fail-safe mechanism. It's got a feedback that says, look, if it's not being received, stop immediately.
Yeah, well, the...
Nothing can go wrong.
Yeah. Okay, well, I will predict quite firmly that we will never have that technology.
That's really?
My prediction.
Really?
Yes.
And you base that on what, the expense to get it there,
or the danger?
The danger.
Maybe they can get around the danger, but they can't get around the expense. You know, maybe someday they'll put up some test thing, you know, that only covers, you know, a few hundred square yards or something like that of collector area. I mean, face it, you need to have huge areas covered to get any amount of energy. You know, the amount of sunlight falling on a square foot of area, even out in outer space, isn't that big. You know, you got to have huge areas of collectors to make a dent in our energy needs. I just attended an annual briefing by ExxonMobil, and this is done by all of the petroleum companies, where they predict where they think energy use is going to go in the next 25 years, what countries are going to be growing in their needs, and where that energy is going to come from. And basically, petroleum, coal are the two major things.
Huh.
The renewables are going to be increasing rapidly, you know, like solar and wind.
Yes.
But they're going to be increasing rapidly from very small percentages to only somewhat bigger percentages. You know, it's just going to take a long time before they can cut into the market of the demand, especially with, like I said before, India and China. It's at the point now where the developing countries right now are producing as much CO2 as the developed countries are.
Wow.
And they are going to rapidly surpass us in the coming years.
Two cars in every garage in
yeah,
Shanghai and, you know, wherever. I'm sure that's what they want. I mean, the rest of the world basically wants what we've got, and we all know what we went through from an industrial point of view to get here. So, yeah,
that's
they
right.
want it too, and why shouldn't they?
Yeah.
So it comes down to, I guess, a matter of who's right. There's one other thing I want to ask you about. We're at a break point. Can you afford to... just stay a few more moments.
Sure.
Okay. Not Fret, open lines coming up directly after this segment with Dr. Spencer. Just way too good an opportunity not to take advantage of. And by the way, Dr. Spencer, you have a website, don't you?
Yeah, I've got a few. I guess the two that I enjoy the most these days. One is called EcoEnquirer.com,
uh-huh.
which is sort of an environmental satire website. All the stories there, they're faux news stories on environmental topics.
Mm-hmm.
And it's up to the people reading them to see whether they're true or not. I'll give you a hint. I made them all up, but it's people can't tell half the time
yes.
which ones are made up. And then also weatherstreet.com is a nice forecasting site that me and another guy put together. It doesn't have all those flashing ads and stuff that bug you so much on the big weather website. So those are the
good.
Two, ecoenquirer.com and weatherstreet.com.
Weatherstreet.com. Well, they'll take a lot of hits now, so I hope you're ready.
Yeah, please don't bring down the servers, though.
We have brought down some of the best, Doctor.
Oh, I'll bet you have.
We have. Now, there is this project up in Alaska called HARP, and it's a very interesting project, and perhaps you can't even comment on this, but what they're doing is transmitting, ultimately, 1 billion watts of effective radiated power or more, From an antenna array that is large on the ground, and then by the time it hits the ionosphere, it's designed to be a pinpoint. In other words, opposite of what most antennas are. Most antennas start out as a very narrow beam and become very wide and very dispersed. HARP is going to put this incredible amount of energy, they've already begun doing it, into a sort of a pinpoint location in the ionosphere. And it got so interesting a few weeks ago that there was an auroral display going on above the facility in Alaska, and they turned this thing on, and they actually saw these sparkly, this whole sparkle show that went on above them as they began to affect the ionosphere. And there are all kinds of stated goals for this project, like locating underground tunnels and bunkers, radio propagation research, and then there are some more shadowy goals because the government now has gotten hold of this project, DARPA, I believe, actually. And I guess what I'm working up to here is, A, do you know about this project? B, what effect could it conceivably have on the atmosphere? Let's start there.
Okay, well, I've certainly heard of HARP.
Yes.
I have never read the details.
Ah.
I don't have the level of knowledge you have. But I will say that from a physics standpoint, we basically don't have to worry about anything going on in the ionosphere when we do climate forecasting, weather forecasting, explaining how the climate system works right now. In other words, it's like the ionosphere is totally disconnected from weather.
Mm.
Even the stratosphere, which is the next layer up from where we live, has relatively little influence. And you're talking about way above that. Also, considering the amount of energy that's involved, a single small thunderstorm is like a small nuclear warhead going off, like a 20 kiloton at least.
Mm-hmm.
You've got thousands of these going on all the time around the world. Basically, the amount of energy that's involved in weather processes is so huge, I don't think we could alter weather if we tried to with a bunch of nuclear weapons.
Well, you know,
even forgetting the mess we would have in terms of radioactive fallout.
Oh, well, sure. But that was actually going to be my next question. I think it's the Army that has a website up that says they'll own the weather in another 50 years or something. That's probably somewhat optimistic. But do you think any sort of control will ever be possible? And if so, how would it, or how might it be achieved?
I very much doubt it because of the amount of energy required to change anything. Now, the only reason why I won't say that with 100% certainty is we know that these weather systems are nonlinear in their behavior. In other words, a weather system could be just on the verge of turning into a huge storm or dissipating into nothingness.
Exactly.
And if somebody could identify a system, you know, in the right stage where you didn't know which way it was going to go, if you put enough energy in there in the right places with, and all I can think of is nuclear weapons, which you wouldn't want to do, it might be possible to nudge it in one direction. So that's the only reason why I'm willing to admit that, yes, you might be able to do something in the future, but to make it do what you want it to do, I don't know.
Okay. And that leads me to another question, whether it's HARP or whether it's an attempt to control the weather or anything else that science does, how comfortable are you with the oversight and the ethics? I've seen scientists do some pretty strange things. It's kind of like when you get down to the very end and you're ready to push the button, do you press it or not? And more times, you know, the scientists, without thinking about possible larger societal consequences, inevitably push the button.
Oh, well, they don't give me any buttons to push at work, so I don't get to do that fun stuff.
but you see the basis of my question.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. Well, there's no question that, well, okay, in a general sense, I will say that probably just about any technology that we've developed can be used for good or evil.
Oh, yes.
So, you know, there's always moral decisions involved. That's my belief.
Okay.
So, yeah, I mean, so in a sense, I guess I'm agreeing with you.
All right. On the culture, the climate at NASA, you know,
for the most part, NASA is a very open organization. Okay, they want to foster knowledge. They want to fund, you know, the finding, the discovery of knowledge.
Yes,
they're probably a little more in the direction of we need to save the Earth. But at the same time, we need to save our jobs, so let's keep doing climate research. But for the most part, you know, they're very open, and I never had any overt pressure when I was at NASA about what I could and couldn't do. About the most it went was when I would testify in Congress, they would just remind me that I'm there to give my expert testimony and what I'm expert in, because when you testify in Congress on global warming, inevitably a congressman or a senator is going to ask you, what would you do if you were me about policy change? You know, because they're, you know, they don't know what to do. And I don't blame them. I'm glad I'm not in their position and trying to decide what to do.
And so NASA would advise you to say, I'm sorry, Senator, policy's not my field.
Yeah, yeah. So I dodge the question, and then all the senators laugh at me because I sound like a politician. And that's one of the reasons why I left NASA, is I didn't want to feel like a politician.
I see. So, well, that is a pressure of a kind, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, but I could understand
why?
Their position,
uh-huh.
That I'm only speaking on what I'm an expert in, and so I played that game. It was their rules. That's fine with me. But then I decided to leave. Now, Jim Hansen is still there. But he has political power. I mean, he's done more than anybody probably in the world in terms of bringing global warming into the consciousness of humanity. You know, it started with him testifying for Al Gore back in 88 or 89, whatever it was. And he's a very good scientist. So he could take the risk. I mean, they wouldn't be able to fire him without a huge political backlash.
Oh, that would be bad.
Oh, yeah. So he's, you know, he's safe. It could be that they mishandled how the whole thing was handled afterwards. I don't know.
Well, I had a guest on who said, look, it was nothing more than some NASA admin person with a bit of irrational exuberance in protection of, I don't know, whatever, that resulted in the whole dust-up with Dr. Hansen.
That sounds like the most plausible explanation to me, based on my experience with NASA.
You think he'll... do you think he will now even further increase the strident tone that he's had lately, or how
well,
do you...
He's had a pretty strident tone lately.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
Hard for me to imagine it getting more severe than it is now, but who knows? You know, he's on a mission. He's trying to save the world. I understand what he's trying to do.
Well, there has to be some percentage of chance that he is right. And
that's
if he,
true, there is.
And if he is right...
I have no idea what that percentage is, though.
Well, right. But if he is right, then, of course, the world is in some degree of fairly serious trouble. And raising his voice to that degree, you said it earlier, you'd probably have done the same thing if you believed as he did or
yeah,
does.
I think I would. I think I would step out there and take the chance like he did, yes.
Since you're not testifying now before Congress, you really could answer that question here if you wish to.
Actually, I can, because now that I've, you know, been testimony now since I'm a university employee, you know, university people, as you can tell from the news lately, get to say whatever they want to, right?
Yeah, sure.
Huh?
Absolutely, yes. Just whisper it in my ear.
Yeah. Oh. No, I have definite feelings about policy. And that is, let's see if I can put it in a nutshell. In order to solve this energy problem to where we have energy sources that don't produce a lot of carbon dioxide, it is going to take research and development. It is going to take technological advancement. Which countries of the world can afford that? It's the countries that have built enough wealth to where we can invest the money into that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my feeling of current legislation about restricting CO2 production, those things are going to hardly put a dent in the problem. But they are going to hurt the economies and therefore hurt our ability to do research and development to find the to finally solve these problems about how we're going to solve our energy needs in the next 50 to 100 years.
Isn't that, though, kind of a negative feedback situation? In other words, the size of the problem is so gigantic that, from your point of view, what we're doing right now is just virtually insignificant in moving toward solving it.
So we aren't going to solve it until we develop energy technologies that are much cleaner. For instance, there are a couple of coal-fired power plants that are working now. I think one is in Texas, one is in North Dakota, that removes most of the carbon dioxide during the burning of coal. It's called a clean coal technology, and then they just pump the carbon dioxide back into the ground. So that's one possibility. And then you've heard about hydrogen, and that technology is actually farther out than I think most people realize. There are too many technical problems with it, not the least of which is, you know, where do you get the hydrogen? It doesn't occur naturally. You have to make it, and that takes energy.
Well, isn't that true of most of these? In other words, even solar panels in mass take energy to produce. It's almost always going to take energy, it seems like.
Well, now, not for solar panels. I mean, it's all virtually all the energy you're getting. You know, you're not having to put energy into the system. Whereas hydrogen, you know, you have to put, for all the energy that you're going to get out of the hydrogen, you have to put in to create it in the first place.
Hear, hear. The president was touting for a time, and I guess still is, the hydrogen economy, he calls it. You feel it's not in the short term anyway?
No, I don't think it is. I'm not sure what the president's motivation in all this. What I fear is that he's trying to placate too many constituencies at one time. Because I feel like some of the stuff he's said lately about future energy is exaggerated or overly optimistic.
Hmm. Well,
that's from what I hear from my, you know, sources in the energy industry. So.
Right. There are those who believe that we are at peak oil, perhaps now. And so we're going to need something, and we're going to need it pretty soon. If you were able to formulate policy right now, how much urgency would you put into alternative energies? And
well,
money.
It's a multi-billion-dollar program already for the U.S. Now, I don't know enough about policy to know whether it's enough. You know, I'm not knowledgeable enough to give you an answer to that.
Does it deserve? Do you think it might deserve something along the lines of a Manhattan-style project to make fast changes, or is that just not realistic?
Well, I think that makes a certain amount of sense, yes.
Huh. All right. Have you written, you've done a lot of writing for a lot of journals, very prestigious journals. Do you write about this sort of thing?
On policy, just in generalities. One technology that I've been real interested in, and which is apparently they're going to start construction of it in Australia soon, is called a solar chimney or solar tower.
Yes.
Where basically you build a big transparent canopy over the ground that covers several square miles.
Uh-huh.
And it's usually in the desert where it's hot and sunny. So basically that heat, that or the solar heating that occurs underneath that panel on the ground can't escape the way it normally does during the day with convective motions in the atmosphere constantly taking the heat away from the ground. It's trapped under that canopy. It all goes towards a central tower and up a chimney. And then the turbines are in the chimney. So it's like a self-contained circulation every day. In fact, it continues at night because the ground is still warm and generates. The design they're working on in Australia is hundreds of megawatts.
No kidding.
Yeah, and I think it's a pretty cool design.
That's actually kind of exciting, and I've never heard of that before.
Yeah, it's called the solar tower or solar chimney design. You can do a search on the internet about it.
Okay.
And I think it has promise. They claim that they think it's getting cost competitive with coal-fired power plants. Not quite there, but
My
then
goodness.
They actually haven't built a big one yet. Built a very small one in Spain years ago that operated for about like 5 years and only generated like 50 kilowatts.
Huh. I live in the state of Nevada, where we have lots and lots of sun, and we also have lots and lots of government land. About 90% of my state is government land. So it would seem to me that would be a place where government could take the lead and
exactly.
actually do something.
And I've been trying to get an answer from the Department of Energy, and from what I can tell, they are not even researching this technology in the United States. The government isn't, and I don't understand why. I haven't been able to get an answer from anybody about why they're not.
Well, there is an answer to that somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. There's an answer. I just don't know it.
Well, I think a lot of us do, and I think perhaps at one level you probably have a pretty good idea. Listen, you've been great, Dr. Spencer, absolutely great, and I would hope to have you on again sometime as we, you know, get a little further down the road and events warranted. I'd love to have you on again.
Okay, Art.
Dr. Spencer, thank you, and good night.
Thank you.
There you have it, folks.